You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
We're delving into the unknown, but probably we know a little more than most people think about this subject. But we have with us a very eminent person. Eminent because he's learned and he'll knock us into a cocked hat. And I've got a feeling he is a real professor. He's a real professor. I'd like to call him the doc, but he's a professor. He's an associate professor. Have a listen to this. He's an you checking what I'm saying on your phone, are you? He's an associate professor.
Oh, I think he's a real professor.
I've got a feeling we have a real professor here. He is an associate professor with an interest in endoscopic management of urinary tract pathology. He has studied in Australia and at the University of California, and his particular interest is in urinary stone disease. I'm not going on any further with these credentials because I will end up having no idea what I'm talking about if I don't already. He is the great Professor Damien Bolton, and we're very, very happy to have you here, Professor.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Don. Very kind of you.
I know your first question. I know. Go ahead.
Can we clear up professor, associate professor and adjunct professor? Because I think that Brett Sutton's nothing.
Well, they're all different levels of professorship and I've had them all. I'm at the professor now, but they're just varying levels
of
association.
So what is Brett Sutton?
I couldn't tell you, to be honest.
We think he's an adjunct professor. Don't get yourself in hot water.
There'd be a uni website about that that would tell you.
Now, Damien.
Yes. Go on. Now, I know that, but I thought you were waiting for me to ask a question. You haven't said you want to take it over.
It seems to me, I shouldn't, well, not a racket, but a lot of men, I think too many men, are getting or suffering from this disease, this cancer called prostate cancer.
Prostate
cancer.
Jesus Christ.
Don't blaspheme. What is going on, and why are so many men, I think it's more than what women have, breast cancer? What's going on with it?
Well, you're right. Large numbers of men will get it, and it didn't used to be that much of an issue when the life expectancy of men was to their early 70s, because not that many men will die of prostate cancer in their 60s. But once the life expectancy of men has increased out to the mid to late 80s, as it's done over the past 30 to 40 years, you find now that about 1 in 20 men will get really clinically significant prostate cancer, and half of them will die of it. So it's a huge...
So some will die with it?
Absolutely. So in the background, there are other forms of prostate cancer that are less aggressive, and that's a bit like grey hair. You know, it's not going to be that much of a worry. But if you've got the aggressive form, yes, you will die of it if you live long enough.
Virtually speaking, every man will die with it. Whether it kills them or not
if you live long enough, you'll find traces of it. But those traces are not the key thing, and it's not what we look for. What you want to look for is the aggressive cancer.
It's not a fashionable thing,
Fashionable to have prostate cancer.
Well, it just seems to be so many. Every guy that you talk, not every, well, just so many men have got it.
Well, there has been a sort of increase in awareness of it now with PSA testing, blood testing for it, and more recently MRI scanning for it.
Hang on, what do you, can I bring you up?
Yeah, sure, mate.
MRI wasn't around when certainly John and I had the operation, which was on mine in 2010, I think it was. What is MRI scanning got to do with it now?
It used to be that when someone's PSA was mildly elevated, they would have almost routinely a prostate biopsy, and that led to identification of a lot of insignificant tumours, the kind that John was saying before that you die with, that people would just keep an eye on it. And then,
so hang on, can I ask you a question here? Yeah. This is called the Gleason score, isn't it, when you do a biopsy on the tumour?
Exactly.
On the cancer. So you're now saying that this biopsy is no longer relevant?
Well, the biopsy that was purely PSA-based would lead to a lot of low-grade tumours, these Gleason score 6 tumours being identified, and that's why lots of men find they've got prostate cancer, but they just keep an eye on it. But with the MRI, that will identify the higher-grade tumours more often than not at the time of the biopsy.
Very simple layman's question, Prof.
Yep.
You can either have the blood test or you can have the digital... you can have the
yep.
digital...
But you have both, don't you?
Well, I'm just... Don, we've got a professor in here. This is my question. Is it better to have the blood or is to have someone digitally? Don had the digital and then...
And the blood.
Yeah.
And then when he'd finished with the digital, he said, could you put 2 fingers up? And the bloke said, why? He said, I want a second opinion. What is better?
Initially, the blood test will be the better thing. I mean, the blood test is a very accurate guide and an extremely good marker of prostate disease. Not necessarily prostate cancer, but prostate disease.
Okay, can we talk on the PSA?
Yeah.
Now, I can only talk about myself. Now, my PSA went up and down. Started at 5.1, dropped to 1.9, slowly climbed. This is, and I was doing it every 3 months. I could not get an explanation as to why it had dropped, why it went to 1.9 and gradually, and at 3.2, they said, it's dangerous, we better operate. Yet I know of another doctor, 7.1, and I don't know what John...
13.
He was at 13. Now, what, mate, you got such a range.
Professor.
Yeah.
Professor.
Not mate.
Well, mate... Because
he's an eminent man. Don't call him mate.
Why is a PSA an indicator if you've got that range?
Well, PSA will rise for numerous reasons, but not all PSA rises are related to prostate cancer, but prostate cancer is one of the reasons it will rise. So often...
Give me the other reasons why it'll rise.
Well, benign growth of the prostate over time, infection in the prostate, inflammatory change in the prostate, all kinds of things.
So I could have been operated on... without needing to be operated on, if you're telling me there are other reasons for the rise in the prostate?
Well, if there's a rise in the PSA level,
PSA.
Often that'll be the reason to do the MRI and the biopsy, and then it comes down to the Gleason score that you mentioned before. If your Gleason score is high, then that correlates with more aggressive tumour.
Have you found that doctors just... knee-jerk reaction to the rise in the PSA level, they just say, well, just let's take your prostate out. Or is this just a money-making thing for docs to rip out of your prostate when it's not really necessary? Ruin your sex life, doc. Yeah.
Exactly, and also Prof. pissing yourself.
Thank you, doc. Urination. Urinary tract is his specialty, not pissing, right? Respect, please.
I don't
see we're aggressive.
No, well, it's understandable.
I'm shitty with the whole system.
I don't think people take out the prostate unless there's an indication for it. And
that'd be you know, thank heavens.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's a key thing. Most people, I think, do a very sort of thoughtful and appropriate kind of consideration of when someone needs operation. In terms of the cost of it, this is a sort of a pet. What would you say? Pet issue for mine. There is no reason for someone to be paying that amount of money. It's really a historic thing related to circumstances at the time. There is absolutely no reason why someone should be paying that amount of money for an operation.
This is what you're charging.
No, that's not the case at all, right? There are a couple of people who cashed up majorly. The vast, vast majority of people, and I think probably you'd say... 90%, 99% of urologists in practice are nothing like those people. And that's
Is that right?
Absolutely. And that has sort of become...
this all published? This is what gave me the shits.
John.
You can see that I'm emotive about it because there was no information about, maybe when we went through it 10 years ago, nobody told me. The only person who told me something was John's friend. And men are really unaware of what all of this goes on. The cost, the various means of the operation,
yep.
It's just black. There's nothing out there.
you said about the cost. It's just for the people listening to this, and as I say, it's oriented to the men, but women are vitally interested in this for a number of different reasons, because probably the libido and the sex drive of the people they're with drops right away. We can attest to that, but that's another thing we'll ask you about. What is the average? Well, not the average. What is the high end cost of having your prostate out that you think is exorbitant? It's about $16,000?
So that is completely ridiculous.
Is it $16,000?
You know, I can tell you I've never charged anyone half that amount in my life. That is
well,
just
I got $15,000.
Yeah, well, that's ripped
with the
off, mate.
With
yeah.
the robotic yeah, surgery.
But, John, there is no reason people should be charged that amount, right? That's just, I mean, and you wouldn't buy, I don't know, a car without finding what it was at two dealerships. Someone's just charged you a huge amount.
But they say the technology of the robot, which is where you should explain this better, but where the surgeon sits on the other side of the room and operates with a remote control thing on a big television screen, never touches the patient. Is that right? Never touches the patient?
Robot is inserted. The arms of the robot are inserted, and you do operate on a console remotely. And I'm the first to agree that's a long and difficult operation. And, you know, I mean, I do two a week, but it's crazy to be charged $15,000, right? That should never happen.
But it's much more intricate, so you cannot sever the tendons and nerves which might affect other parts of your body. It's because it's more enlarged on a big screen. Is that vaguely correct, or
that's
is that layman's
No, that's entirely correct. So it is much more precise. It's done in full 3D imaging with the software that's available with the robot console. It's a phenomenal piece of technology, but it's widely available and it is not that cost. And cost should never be an impediment to treating prostate cancer.
So if you didn't have the money, you would have to go to the private system, the public system. You would then have to wait. And would you have a radical procedure? In other words, your stomach cut open and you are operated in that fashion instead of six little incisions in your stomach.
With a man wearing binoculars on his face so he could see.
So that is largely correct. Can you give me a couple of minutes? Because this is my pet sort of issue.
Go ahead.
For people like me who get prostate cancer, for sake of example, if it's a doctor or someone with a white-collar job, typically you come into the private hospital, you have it treated through the keyholes, you've get back on the work on the computer a couple of days later, and you know often these people have these insurance policies that pay out a couple of $100,000 on the way through. They have minimal morbidity, but for someone like a patient who might have a family business, self-employed, runs a post office franchise, he's a delivery driver, that guy has to wait. He has a big cut in his belly because the public system doesn't provide enough robotic facility. His time off work 6 weeks. He can't go back to work sooner because he's got a big cut, he's got a hernia, he does a manual job. And the impact financially upon that guy is just disproportionate to someone in the private system who gets treated by keyhole. And I think there's an imperative, really, for the government to support more in the way of robotic technology in the public system.
And also, can I also add, if that particular person, overweight, yeah. he's then sent back. Sorry, you're overweight, we're not going to operate on you. So go and lose some weight. Well, how long is it going to take for him to lose weight to be operated on in the public system?
With a robot, you can operate on people who are bigger more easily.
Have you got your prostate?
Well, it's
kind you
of,
haven't.
Can I tell you? I get my PSA checked all the time. I've had it checked twice this year.
Do you do it? How often?
Do the PSA twice
yes.
a year.
So well, your prostate. You have a prostate.
I'm a male. I've got a prostate.
No. Well, we're males. We haven't got a prostate.
Yeah. So, oh, no, I know what you're saying. No, get my PSA checked twice a year.
So,
do you think that's enough?
Yeah, once or twice a year is enough.
Why do some men get prostate cancer and others don't? What is the trigger? Or haven't we worked that out yet?
So, there are different reasons. If you are from a family that's got a high genetic risk of prostate cancer, you're way more predisposed to get aggressive prostate cancer younger. And like there are examples of this, particularly in breast cancer. Everyone would be aware with the name of the actor and director Angelina Jolie, who had the BRCA gene and decided to have the mastectomy and have her ovaries out. And that gene does affect your rate of getting prostate cancer as well. Beyond that, There are other risk factors. You know, if you're overweight, you're at a higher risk of prostate cancer. You know, the older you get, the more likely you are to have prostate cancer.
So I hate to speak about it, but might as well speak about it personally. I didn't have it in my family at all, and I was pretty fit. And I went in to have a blood spot. I thought it was a sunspot. Yep. My GP, and he said, "No, that's benign. I can tell. But don't waste the Medibank levy. Give us your blood. You may as well see how you." And he rang me up in 2 days after. He said, "Mate, you've got an advanced case of prostate cancer." I had no symptoms, nothing, didn't have any problems. And the doctor that he recommended me to was lecturing in Japan and on the robotic system. And as soon as he got back, I was booked in. Within a fortnight of being diagnosed, I had it out because my PSA was, I think, 13 or 14 or 15. So I didn't have...
Really? That high?
Yes, I didn't have any. And he said, "It's as you would know this, why am I telling you this? It's important to contain it in the capsule so it doesn't get out. You might explain that."
Exactly.
And I had it out, and he said it was contained in the capsule. And what is the function of a prostate? Why does it reduce your sex drive? Why does it... Why does your libido drop off? What is the operation? Absolutely. That's downside. Everyone must say that to you. Your clients say, "My sex drive and my libido are just non-existent." Why is all that?
Well, the function of the prostate is that it makes a component of the semen that's vital for activation of the sperm. So it's a fertility organ. After the operation, as you say, there's a reduction in the sensation of ejaculation, and that in turn often leads to a reduction in libido. That's the basis for it.
Does it ever?
Hang on. So that affects an erection, does it?
Well, the erection is a secondary thing to the prostate. The prostate itself has a fairly minimal role in erectile function, but the nerves for penile erection are immediately adjacent to the prostate. And often in the process of the removal of the prostate or radiation of the prostate, they will be damaged.
It will be damaged, or is it the skill of the surgeon not to damage it?
Well, there's always some degree of, disruption of those nerves, because they're like threads of cotton immediately adjacent to something that's got blood flow to it, and you have to control the blood flow. But often you can preserve those nerves.
Okay, now I'll go on and... You quoted something.
If I may, Prof, is the only function of the prostate there to ensure you get a hard-on, if I may use those terms? Is that the only function of the prostate?
The only function of the prostate is to activate the sperm so that you've got fertility.
So that's vaguely connected. No other reason why the prostate's there?
No.
Well, I found it was like someone had severed me right through my stomach when it came to erectile function. The brain wanted, but it wasn't coordinated to the old fellow. And then whilst it was going through the recuperative thing, you finish up with an erection just laying there, like the nerves obviously come back into play somewhere, and you got an erection, you're not even thinking of sex or whatever else. So it was... You know, the mind is obviously connected. Will you shut your face? So what goes on with regard to that? Can it be repaired, or does it repair, or does erectile function come back?
Yeah, if the nerves are left intact, a lot of people will get their erectile capability back, and that depends largely on your age. A lot of guys who have their operation in their 50s will recover fairly normal erections. If you're in your 60s, it's a bit less. Probably if you're having the operation in your early 70s, it's not going to return.
Okay, what about incontinence?
The vast majority of people get their continence back within 6 to 8 weeks. The number of people who still have significant incontinence a year out from their operation is 1%.
Why does one suffer from incontinence?
The main issue for that is that the pelvic floor muscles, which control continence, sit immediately underneath the prostate. And you've got to have them stronger after the operation to compensate for the absence of the prostate.
So what does the prostate control?
Control
urinary flow?
To some extent, it restricts urinary flow. So the pelvic floor muscles aren't that useful in, or aren't as useful in a older bloke as they might be in a woman where there's no prostate. That's why women do pelvic floor exercises after childbirth, after menopause all the time. But for men, those pelvic floor muscles need to play a greater role in urinary continence when the prostate's been removed.
So that is why, okay, so what is it, like a valve being taken out?
Yeah, effectively, or a valve that's got one, the valve that remains has more to do, has a higher pressure to occlude.
Prof, would you mind if I just asked him a question?
Sure.
Did I take it that you said, Don, that you can lie after you've had your prostate out and just get a hard-on involuntarily?
No, when I was recuperating,
you
I remember
tell
laying
us how
in
that
bed.
Happened. You could help me through life. If you can just get a hard-on lying there, when I'd like to see
okay,
it.
I'll tell you. Laying there, you know, recuperating, rehabilitating, and for some reason, I remember distinctly on a number of occasions, I'd get an erection just laying in early morning. Yeah. Now, it's not as... What are you laughing at, you idiot?
I'm laughing at that.
Why?
Why did you get... What?
I don't know. That's
birds tweeting or the sun coming up? What gave you an erection?
Well, I'm laying in bed by myself about to get up and this is what happened. I'm trying to ask you these questions as to why this happens because there's nobody out there could tell me and there's no support. There's nothing. I think it's the most unorganised...
Disorganised
thing. There should be some support groups or people talking like this to tell men what goes on, or people what goes on.
Well, that's a nerve function thing, and it shows the nerves are still connected, and probably there's more in the way of activity of those nerves at that time, and in many ways it's a good thing if that's happening.
So do nerves grow back together? Do you sever them, and do they kind of attach again?
Well, the nerves will regrow. The central bit of the nerve will regrow, provided it's been left intact. If you even sort of... cause any minimal damage to those tiny nerves, then their function won't be perfect. So even when we leave them intact, their function's not there straight away. But they do regain their activity over time, yeah.
So, Professor Damien Bolton, could I ask you this, knowing he's just here listening to this? I'm staggered by about him saying involuntarily lying there, and I'm not being silly about this, I'm not sending him up, getting an erection, because he is the man that has told us, I've never engaged in this, and he's spoken about this publicly, so I'm not betraying a confidence. He says that he has to have, or he uses aids like injections. How does an injection work to get yourself erect? Pumps, how does that work? And I
implants?
I said to him, if I ever have to inject myself or get a pump or an implant to get a hard-on, that's it, I'll wind it up. So I've not engaged in any of that, but... Here's a man who can involuntarily get a hard on lying in bed and yet has to have a pump and an injection to get himself up.
Now,
is all that?
Well, for people who really want to maintain their normal erectile function afterwards,
sex life.
Yeah. These injections are no big deal. I mean,
they're bloody expensive.
That's a really good thing to notice, that you think it's expensive and not difficult to do. But you're right, they cost $20, $30 an
well
injection.
Well done. But you can get a vial,
yeah.
And you can withdraw and regulate it.
Giving the injection is no big deal. I mean...
What?
Geez, the first time it is.
No, but how debilitatingly unromantic to have a partner there, man, woman or beast, and you have to say, just hang on, and you reach for the drawer and get out an injection and jam it into your member. Is that how it works?
If the timing might be different, but yeah, you've got to give yourself the injection. But I mean, you can teach a child to give themselves an injection four times a day.
Stick a needle into your dick.
Well, a child will give themselves into their abdomen an injection four times a day for diabetes. No trouble learning this.
No, you're dead on. It's just...
I mean, there's a sort of a sense that you can't imagine doing it, but it's a means to get an outcome and you'll do it.
But Don, and I'm not winding you up, Don says that he can involuntarily, why would you need to do that if you can just get it in bed for no reason? Why, when you get someone you might be interested in and want to do it, why wouldn't it manifest itself just on that occasion?
Well, I guess that...
Did you think you were going to be asked any of these questions? We're happy for you to speak about anything you want because we're learning and so will our listeners, but... We're interested in that side of it.
These are the questions I would deal with every day. So it's not a...
You deal with it every day, do you?
Absolutely. Multiple times a day. I would talk to probably 6-10 guys a day about exactly
this. About their sex life.
About their prostate cancer, about complications of prostate cancer, outcomes of it. And the truth is, we, you know, blokes like yourselves who've had this surgery and are got a good outcome and the cancer's been found when it's confined to the prostate and it hasn't spread, I mean, that is just the biggest stroke of luck you will get.
Luck, is it?
Well, every day I will have the opposite conversation with someone where the PSA is not 13, but it's 130.
What?
And they say your PET scan is positive.
Hang on, Woo.
Yeah?
Why would it get up to 130?
Well, it's just been ignored. They haven't had it tested.
So they've never had a test in...
Absolutely.
Okay.
I never had a test, ever.
Rodney, have you had a test? How old are you? How old should you be to have it start having tests?
Probably around 50 if you don't have a family history.
Oh, don't put your hands up, you.
No, because you're bagging me about it.
So we like to pride ourselves on the bottom of the world here, that no one's ever heard of us, that we almost lead the world in a lot of technology and medical facilities. You studied in the University of California. What did you go over there to study? This particular facet of medical procedure, or did you go over to lecture, or what? Just tell us why you went over there.
When you finish your surgical training in Australia, it's very common for people to want to do additional training elsewhere in the world, and I knew of a good professor who I'd been introduced to previously who worked at the University of California, and I initially took a job for a year there as a fellow, so you kind of do all of the things with this guy that he does, and one of which was prostate cancer. And then after a year, I stayed on as an assistant professor.
Now, what fascinates me, there's a lot of, you would say, and I'm not saying this is one of them, but there's a lot of unsavoury things that doctors could get into, like studying colons and gynaecology, and not unsavoury, but just why did you pick this profession to get into? Why did you have an interest in that when you could have done almost anything? Because you're a learned medical professor.
Look, I think it's just what seems like a good thing at the time. I had a guy who was helpful to me at that point. The guy sort of gave me a bit of career direction, and it seemed like an interesting thing to do. I liked the operating that was with it.
So you go to a university to study medicine, and then you decide what area you'd like to concentrate on. Is that how it works?
Yeah, exactly.
You don't just go in and say, oh, I want to be a prostate expert on this. No, you just decide to pick one out, do you?
Typically, you go, when you've finished your medicine, you go into different streams. You might go into a medical stream, so you might then be an endocrinologist or cardiologist, or you'd go into a psychiatry stream, or you'd go into a surgical stream, and then from surgery, you might end up doing plastics or... gallbladder work or urology.
Are we regarded or do we stroke ourselves a bit to think we're on the cutting edge of anything down in this country?
No, I think we're very good here. I mean, I don't think there's any perfect healthcare system in the world, but I mean, I've had very good experience in America and in the UK, and I was a visiting operator in France, and I know these systems, and you know the systems from other colleagues worldwide, and I think nothing's perfect, but we're up with the best here.
I've got two questions.
Good.
Out of what you've just said. First one, and then I'll come back to the other one. When I was into this, which was, you know, 8-10 years ago, there were three organisations in Melbourne doing their own research. Monash, Royal Melbourne and Austin. Why didn't the three of them consult with one another? Was it ego? They're all looking for a cure for or examining or going into prostate cancer. Yet there was no dialogue between those three organisations. Have those three organisations mended their ways? Are they working to a common goal? Because to me, you seem the people that are operated on are the guinea pigs.
No, I think that was correct. There was... I think historic and personal reasons for all of that, but it's a much more collaborative bunch now. And in fact, we have a very good association with Monash University in particular.
Who are you with?
So I'm primarily with the Olivia Newton-John Cancer Centre in the Austin, but I have a very good working relationship with the other two. My former deputy head of department at the Austin's become the head at the Royal Melbourne. Another guy who is a fellow for me is the head at Monash. We all get on very
well. So you're all now working for a common goal.
Absolutely.
That's fantastic. Now, the other thing, we just talked about the injection before. What other means are there for erection?
Playboy? Penthouse?
Yeah.
Porn?
I think if your nerves aren't intact, those things aren't going to do it for you. But as you mentioned, the injections, the vacuum device, as you said.
Okay, well, explain the vacuum device. I know nothing. Well, tell me about it.
Well, often people will use these vacuum devices to draw blood into the penis to give them a satisfactory
erection. So what do? You put a cap over your penis and what? Have a pump and
that's exactly it. Yeah, exactly.
And what
it.
Draw blood in?
Yeah, exactly.
So how do you hold the blood in there?
It's often a rubber ring that will go around the base of the penis.
So doc, prof, you've got Miss World or Mr. America, whichever is your proclivity. You've got them back at home, and you've had a couple of cocktails, and you're about to climb into the rack, and you're telling me that it's pretty sexy and pretty stimulating to get a cap, stick it over the end of your member, pump something into it while they're lying there wondering what in the hell you're doing. Is that how it works, or you got to do it beforehand?
No, I'm not telling you it's exciting to do that, but that's how it works, yeah.
Okay, now, you're an idiot.
Hey, so, or him.
Okay, that's the pump. Now, I've heard there's an implant that you press a button or something. Is that right? You have an implant inserted in your penis. What's all that about?
So that's correct. There are these plastic devices.
Shut up, Rodney.
These plastic devices that will be inserted, and they have a...
inserted through your eye of your...
No, actually inserted through an incision on the undersurface of the penis.
Wow.
And they'll have then a... external pump that's located above your testicle. And
hang on.
Like a bite tube.
Not quite, but analogous.
No, explain this. So you put something underneath the penis.
Put it sort of inside the erectile tissue of the penis.
Right.
And then when you want to inflate it, there's a little internalised...
How do you inflate it?
It's got a button that you press...
Where's the...
It's inside the scrotum. You've above your testicle.
You've got a compressor testicle. Out in the garage.
Shut up. So you wear a button. You have two devices, a button and a...
Well, they are connected. The button is inside the scrotum above the testicle, usually above the left testicle, and you press it and it'll inflate.
You're joking.
No, it's not an uncommon thing at all.
Now, this is a clumsy question. Do the African and Asian nations, people from those populations, we never hear about it, are they as prevalent and susceptible to prostate cancer, or is it more a developed world problem? Do you see a lot of people from overseas countries?
That is a really good question.
Thank heavens.
So your incidence of prostate cancer is very much tied to your life expectancy. Where these countries have life expectancies for men in their 60s, it's not a common thing at all. But where you get to countries where people live longer, they're... incidence of prostate cancer is much greater. So Australia has one of the longest life expectancies in the world, and as you'd expect, our incidence of prostate cancer is very high. Now, having said that, there are these genetic variabilities. If you're African American, your risk of prostate cancer is much higher than for Caucasian men.
In America?
In America.
Why is that?
Why is that?
It's thought to be a genetic. I think it's a genetic thing for these people. And then, strangely, if you're in Japan, your risk of prostate cancer is relatively low compared to the
rest. Is that diet?
Again, I think it's more a genetic thing. There's a lot of homogeneity of their genetics in Japan because there's been, you know, a very sort of select, you know, culture and race that's bred over a long time. They haven't had that much in the way of immigration to Japan, and those sort of people, I think. There's probably been a lower risk of prostate cancer that has been present historically over a long time.
Now, friends come to me asking for advice, and some of them have been recommended certain means of treatment. Now, you're obviously an advocate of radical, which is open your surgery, right? Can you explain to me, it's called brachy, hormone and radiation. Are they still... being recommended or used for the treatment of this cancer?
Absolutely. And most urologists, most doctors would have a good understanding of the place of all of those in the treatment of prostate cancer.
What do you recommend? Do you agree with any of those?
Oh, absolutely. They're all appropriate in certain circumstances.
Okay, can I ask you a couple of...
Sure.
Okay. To me, the is radioactive little pellets are inserted. Now, I was told that, you know, they give off radiation, so consequently you're not allowed to, say, nurse your grandchildren. Is that a fallacy?
Well, the radiation seeds, when they go in, will emit radiation for 6 weeks. But in that time, particularly the early time, you probably want to limit your association with young children. But I did have a patient once who was a paediatrician, and we went to a lot of effort with the Department of Health in Canberra to ascertain whether he would be able to still work because he was emitting this radiation. And I think the likelihood of you doing any damage from passing secondary radiation to someone who you, a child who you're with briefly, is very, very low. But you're right. In that initial month, probably you should stick.
Okay, with that, does that affect any of the things that we've talked about, incontinence and erectile dysfunction, if you have the implant?
Oh, absolutely. It'll give a very similar outcome.
Okay. What was the other one? Hormone treatment.
So hormone treatment is more for advanced disease. If you've got organ-confined disease, like you guys have mentioned about before, you've got disease that's within the capsule.
Yes.
And that is surgically contained, removable, the hormone diseases, hormone treatment is probably not appropriate for that. Hormone therapy is where the disease has escaped.
Okay. And the final, sorry, you upset my chain of thought.
Good,
yeah,
I'm
well,
glad.
Yeah, because you're bloody will, you're not, bloody you're, will not what? You're not tolerant.
The radiation.
Radiation. Now, how can you hit at the spot, or have they got it right now that you can actually hit the spot?
I don't think it's entirely accurate that you hit just the spot of the tumour. There's always surrounding damage.
So that's really not recommended still?
In certain circumstances where you can't remove the prostate, the radiation would be appropriate. And indeed, if you're an older guy, say mid-70s onwards, the life expectancy that comes from treating it with radiation is very similar to that comes from treating it with surgery. It's only really for younger men, 60s, 50s and early 70s, that the outcomes for surgery are better than for radiation.
Have I been tolerant enough for you? Can I ask the professor a question?
Thank you.
Thank you, Don. And now, I don't know if you've touched on it. It says you specialise in urinary stone. What's urinary stone? It's like a kidney stone.
Yeah, lots of urologists would deal with that as well.
There's more than kidney stones. You have urinary stones.
Oh, they'd be one and the same, John.
Oh, this one, pardon me. And now, this is a cancer, of course, and the world is trying to find a cure for cancer. How realistically will we ever get rid of prostate cancer? Will we ever have an injection or a vaccine for it that no one will ever get it, or is that just pie in the sky stuff?
I think it's probably pie in the sky to get a vaccine that would get rid of it. People have looked at it, but prostate cancer takes so many forms. It's very sort of difficult to treat.
What do you
all
mean takes different forms?
Well, it can be this sort of background disease that doesn't really need treatment, like John mentioned before, or it can be really aggressive disease. Occasionally you see people in their 30s with advanced disease.
Really?
This might see you off this question. You'll say, no, we're dealing with complete idiots. Do animals get prostate cancer? Why do humans get it and not other things that live on this planet?
So some animals do get varying forms of prostate cancer, but it just tends not to be a life-limiting thing for them. So the prostate is very different across all mammals. The benign growth of it that comes with age for all men tends to be confined to the human, the dog and the lion.
The dog, human and lion.
Exactly. There's only three species that get the benign growth that comes with age. Now, prostate cancer, again, is very different across the different species, but the only one where it tends to be life-limiting is the human.
Now, Don, I don't know if you've got any other questions. Is there anything we'd be very happy for you to say anything to people who listen to this? We have quite a few listeners all around the planet. I don't want to sound more important than we are, but anything you'd like to say? Or we do appreciate you coming in because we've both had it, Don and I, and there's... We become de facto counsellors for plenty of people who ring up, never heard of, and we try and say, yeah, you got to keep fit and do the core muscles and the core strength muscles and you'll probably piss yourself and all that and your sex drive. That's about as good as we get, but people just have comfort in someone speaking to someone who's had it before and it gives them some sort of level of comfort. Is there anything you'd like to say about
Absolutely.
Any of this?
So, look, first of all, I'm really grateful for the opportunity to be here and I take my hat off to you making this a public issue. Every prostate cancer is curable. The truth is, though, you've got to be willing to have the blood test and then deal with the consequences of that. If you don't have the blood test, you're just rolling the dice and waiting for an inevitable issue to come to the fore. So men have nothing to fear about getting a blood test done. The vast, vast majority of men will be fine. The vast majority of men won't need a biopsy. Even those men who have biopsies, a lot of these tumours are very small and organ-confined and can just be followed expectantly. If you do need an operation, that's now done as you say, in this robotic fashion more often than not. We do have had some recent great assistance from the state government to make that more available to patients in the public sector. No one should be paying $15,000 for it.
I was just going to say, if you left us with one thing without putting words in your mouth, would be that the cost is a little high. It's been probably exploited for those people who think they must have the operation, and maybe some doctors cash in on it.
Who knows the reason for it? But nobody should be paying that amount for it now.
Can I ask one question? Is it better organised? Because at the time when I went through it, a lady friend had breast cancer, and the women seemed to be so well organised that in her area, you know, there was a bit of an overlap. She received two support kits. You know, now I don't know whether they press a button, the women, or it's notified or goes into a file that triggers a support that she received, you know, literature as well as other things in the mail. Now, what about men? Is there anything along that line as far as men are concerned, or should more be done for men? Because we have, you know, Women's Breast Cancer Day at the football, we have the Jane McGrath thing, but there's nothing being done for men in this area.
Oh, you're exactly right. There's a lot more that can be done, but I would say it is better organised now than it used to be. Cancer Council Victoria have great resources available for this, as does Prostate Cancer Foundation of Australia. And I think there's a lot of very broad-minded, very unemotional literature that will help a lot of people. There are counsellors who will do this. And of course, as you say, a large number of men will know someone, whether it's a friend, a family member, a colleague, whatever, who's had prostate cancer. And fortunately now we've reached the time where most men are very happy to talk about this and it's not swept under the carpet.
So this man here, this person we've been listening to, Donald, is a specialist in endoscopic management of urinary tract pathology, and we appreciate him coming in because he is the eminent and great Professor Damien Bolton.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks, Don.
I'm hoping around the streets late at night. I'm worried because you ain't treating me right. Come back again. I'm just crazy about you, babe.